Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week,
I had to stop work. I lost the job. I started taking antidepressants. And I guess that was my moment of just like I'd lost all the things that I looked to make sense of myself.
You know, when people say, this is going to be a great chapter in your autobiography.
Yeah, right.
It's like, yes, but yeah, I'm not writing it yet.
You know, ultimately, if you think of me as some giant jigsaw, there's a part of me that needs a spiritual element. You know, I have to have that there, otherwise I don't work.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
Episode 324, believe it or not, of Mental Health Monday. Thank you for your streams and your downloads and for staying with us for this whole time. If you're just new to the podcast, there's a half-decent back catalogue for you to listen to. I'll keep you busy if you're running the next London Marathon or doing your prep for that one. Thanks for all your feedback for last week's episode with Steve Phillip, the Join the Dots tour, which he's heading across the northern parts of England. Arts, mental health, music, and a whole host of other things involved in that conversation, with zero suicide being at the centre of that conversation. Really appreciate all the feedback I got. LinkedIn's been a really busy one for that one, actually. So appreciate everyone getting in behind that one and listening to the podcast and streaming it. There's actually an arts theme to this week's podcast, actually, with a really fantastic guest who's done some incredible work and is doing some ongoing incredible work within the music space, within the mental health world. And he's using his own experience and his own skill set around music and creativity to take that into places where maybe music and creativity can really flourish, but maybe isn't seen as the number one priority. Now, Gowan Hewitt has been going into psychiatric hospitals, places like Royal Bethlehem, Springfield's Lavender Walk. He's also done work with the City of London Symphonia. He's won awards for the things that he's been doing as well, including the RPS Impact Award. He's also been named a Brits Trailblazer. It's about using music and creativity to give people a sense of their place within the world and to let them explore and find something new and exciting and awesome, if that's the right word, from within themselves, utilizing these incredible opportunities that Gowan and his team create. So it's a really interesting conversation. We'll talk as well as part of this conversation about one of the instruments that Gowan has created, which actually is a plant that you can play. I'll leave it to Gowan to explain that a little bit later on. But it's really interesting, more so because from Gowan's point of view, it comes from a place of his own journey, his own mental health experience across many, many years, including a really difficult time that he had in his life. And there's an ADHD diagnosis within there as well. But also trying to pick out those moments for him and those things for him that really drive him forward, that give him that real sense. And leaving those things to one side that maybe took him down a path that maybe didn't put him in the best place. So Gowan's obviously ongoing in terms of where he's at, in terms of his own journey. But the work that he's doing now is really giving people a great opportunity. It's been really well recognized as well. I've got links in the podcast notes to Gowan's website where you can see some more about the work that he's doing. There's some great little interactive things that you can get involved in there as well, which is really, really interesting too. And he's a fantastic guest. Now, I play musical instruments myself. I do it out of pure pleasure. I do it as well, though, because I feel like learning things is good for my brain. I feel like it's something which allows me to keep things ticking over, learning a new skill. I started playing the ukulele about 5 years ago. That got me back into playing the guitar as well. But at the same time, I knew that when I was growing up, I was playing the piano, and I was kind of only really playing the piano because my mum and dad wanted me to learn to play the piano. So I started off by asking Gowan about how he got into music, whether or not it was that sort of parental-led thing, or whether or not that was something that he was driving himself.
It's kind of a combination of both. I started playing the cello when I was four, and, you know, I guess at four, that's always going to be your parents' choice rather than your own. But I did also grow up in a house surrounded by instruments, and I think the very particular thing about me as a musician is I was never any good at that thing of being a musician who practices hard, who can, you know, if you ask me to play you a tune, I'm going to struggle, actually. But what I was allowed to do, or able to do, or maybe a bit of both, was explore. The house was full of instruments, and I just made stuff up and kept changing my mind. I'm going to do this, going to do that, going to do that. So I've never stuck to any particular instrument, but I think I've just never lost my childhood wonder of creating with music. And actually, I've never known what it's like not to be a musician. You know, when you're four, it's really young, isn't it? So, yeah.
With that, I mean, there's a lot to music, and I play the piano, and I grew up playing the piano, play the guitar now, really enjoy playing the ukulele, a new skill that I've learned. I tend to find as well that there's a thing between the message that you send to your fingers and then the sound that then comes from the thing that your finger does. There's sort of a slight disconnect there, which if it suddenly connects, it creates this sort of almost like a force field around you, which I find to be really awe-inspiring when you get it right. It's also why when it goes wrong, you kind of go, oh, that doesn't chime right. But I find even if we take the mental health side out of it, right from the very off, that music can create that little world around you. And then other people can kind of come into it if they're around as well. And I find that a really positive thing to be sending out into the world.
Oh, it really is. And I really, something I've been thinking about a lot recently is that words are a really imperfect way of communicating. And yet, so, you know, as a society, that's what is what we do. We communicate through words. And sound and music allows me to tap things that I don't have words for and communicate them and connect. You know, if we were having this conversation right now through our guitars, it might be completely different, and we might really struggle to put that into words. So there is something just very powerful, I think, about the ability to communicate, to be in the, I guess it's about being in the world, isn't it? It's about making a noise through sound and music. And I think one of the things that really frustrates me is how in our culture, in the culture I grew up in as an Englishman, music making's being given to the experts. Like, a lot of people don't feel they have any right to make music. And that's a real shame, actually. It doesn't have to be perfect to be helpful.
I remember an old English teacher that I had, you just reminded me. I remember him saying that the thoughts and feelings that we have in our minds, we don't have the means to, the words to express them. And ultimately, that means that we forever end up, ultimately, we're alone in the universe. And I kind of accepted that at face value because it was a teacher saying it and I was at school. But actually, just made a great point there that it was absolute nonsense. What he was saying was, we don't have the words for it. But actually, we can find other ways of making that connection. Music and the arts are the perfect example of that. He didn't include that in his own idea. Maybe he thought that, but yeah, that, absolutely. What a great point made by you, not by him.
Well, yeah. And I think that's my personal journey the last 10 years has really been discovering that, maybe 15 years, discovering that for myself as an artist. Like, who am I? What have I got to offer? Why do I do this? How do I be in the world, you know, as someone who makes sound and art? And the closer I've come to paying attention to who I am and what's coming from within me, the better I feel, but also the more successful I've been. And I don't think that's an accident.
We talk about sort of how your sort of personal journey, and just in terms of where you were in life, how that chimed with your experiences. Music was obviously a big part of your life. You were running a music festival in your early 30s. So obviously it was a passion. It became part of the profession as well.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the church. So, I had quite a strong Christian faith, and that informed how I saw the world. And throughout my 20s, you know, I came to London to make music. That was what I wanted to do. And I didn't go to university. I came to London just, you know, I'm going to be a really important record producer. That was what was in my head. And, you know, I ended up as a waiter in the Hilton National Hotel in Watford, while also being a very important record producer on the side. And I just sort of followed my nose. And I think the thing that, looking back in terms of my mental health, the thing that really strikes me is how, despite having this clear sort of spiritual view of the world and this kind of really radical kind of thing of like, I'm not going to go to university, I'm just going to be a musician, I was still massively ambitious. And I think there is something about being a man that informed that I was not immune to this idea that success looked like accumulating status and that I needed to climb, just climb and succeed and climb and succeed and climb and succeed. And you know, my 20s, yeah, I achieved a lot. I was, as you said, I took a job running a music festival at my early 30s. But actually, the point of doing that, I was overstretching. It was actually a Christian arts festival. I was overstretching my faith and my abilities as a human being. And it led to me having a real crisis. I had a breakdown. I had to stop work. I lost the job. I started taking antidepressants. And soon afterwards, you know, in seeking help at that point, you know, it was kind of, I think this, you know, our literature and our spiritual books are full of kind of metaphors, aren't they, of kind of wildernesses and sort of rock bottom or feeling lost or whatever. And I guess that was my moment of just like I'd lost all the things that I looked to make sense of myself. One was this kind of sort of by that time, a very liberal Christian faith that was just stretched to breaking point. And the other was this sense of self only defined through success. So I could only be someone in the world if I had status and money. And then without both those things, you know, I was seeking help. And that, you know, a few months after that, I ended up, you know, sat with a psychiatrist at the South London and Maudsley, being told I had ADHD, which in itself is, you know, getting my head around that. I had a conversation with a friend yesterday, which was really helpful about it, because I struggle with that. It's a badge, isn't it? And it comes with, you know, popular culture is full of what ADHD is supposed to mean. And sometimes that can feel a little bit like I'm meant to be, oh, poor me, please treat me differently. And it's, oh, I don't want to be like that. And someone yesterday reminded me that, no, it's a way of describing how I am. You know, which comes with some really, really positive things, as well as things that don't fit with the way society expects me to behave all the time. And, you know, I really needed to hear that. Thank goodness for people and friends, eh? Aren't they great?
Absolutely. When the diagnosis came after the event, if you like, did you retrofit it to earlier things that were going on and then think, oh, actually, maybe that was part of the reason why I was struggling at that particular point?
Yeah, it made a lot of sense. There were a lot of things that I was finding hard. And, you know, I think for me, my point of stopping, you know, not being able to cope anymore. Well, I mean, the real danger really was that I tried to cope for so long, you know, so I was, and I guess that's the real learning, isn't it, is to see those warning signs early. But yeah, the ADHD diagnosis, I could map back and go, okay, look, actually, I'm going to need support around here. That might be support for myself. It might just be that I need some tools to think about myself. Maybe there's a time of day that I need to do things, or maybe I need to do things with a different methodology.
You mentioned the idea of like the rock bottom, and then, you know, the 40 days in the desert. If we would draw the sort of the religious sort of story where you have to sort of go away, refind yourself, and then come back as a different character. Was there a rock bottom moment that stands out to you and think, right, well, that was that clear moment now where I can see where all of those things built up to, and then it was about finding your way to a much better place?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. My dad said at the time that this is going to be something you're going to learn from and grow from. I did not want to hear it then. You know, I could kind of see the truth at the time. At the time, so I was like, nah, wrong time, Dad. Wrong time.
You know, when people say, this is going to be a great chapter in your autobiography.
Yeah, right.
It's like, yes, but yeah, I'm not writing it yet.
I mean, I was just way out of my depth. I was just way out of my depth. I didn't have the skills to manage people or a budget of that size, or, you know, I'd achieved a lot at a previous organization through kind of charm and creativity and intuition, but I didn't have any ability to run an organization of that scale. So really, I was only there for 6 months, and the entirety of that was like watching a car crash in slow motion. You know, it was just like, I do not know what I'm doing. And I wasn't able to get my head around that, you know? And so I just kept on trying. I mean, it reverberated for a long time, Mick. You know, you're talking about, was there a moment? I mean, it, 10, 12 years, really, that sat in the background. It led to massive changes. But it's only really, really recently that I've you know, ultimately, if you think of me as some giant jigsaw, there's a part of me that needs a spiritual element. You know, I have to have that there, otherwise I don't work. But it's only really recently I've managed to find a new version that I can slot in there that works for me. And consequently, I feel a lot better. So, you know, that's 15 years ago now that that happened. So, you know, instantly it changed my career. I was like, I remember very clearly being like, Gowan, beware of ambition. You know, beware of your ego. You know, I need to really watch out for these big job titles. Question yourself, why are you doing this? And I went, and this is where I decided to be, you know, an artist and be a practitioner and go back to doing community work and working with people and making things. And actually, it's directly led to me saying no to quite a few things where people have been like, cool, shiny thing over here, we'd like you. And I'm like, no, I'm all right, actually. So I think it's not as clear as there being a definite moment. It's had a long tail, a long tail.
I was just going to say, there's that phrase in the, you know, baby in the bathwater of everything that's been going wrong with my life has led me to this point, so let's get rid of it. But actually, you've just said there that your spirituality was still obviously something that you were keen to do. Music was obviously still a keen part of it, but was it maybe that ambitious side of you that made me think that might be, the toxic trait that maybe corrupts the other two? You've obviously still got a sense that those things that had driven you originally were still things that you wanted to have part of your life.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, spirituality, I did actually discard for most of those 15 years. It was like I was allergic to it. But I guess that wasn't great for me. So reconnecting with a version of that's been important in that way. Yeah, ambition's interesting. You know, it's like, because I am ambitious and I do have an ego, you know. I think learning to be okay with that and recognizing it and has been important. Just this morning, I've just been thinking, you know, I think, how can what I do serve other people? I think that's something that's been quite important in changing how I think. I started seeing a psychotherapist about 5 years ago. And I mean, honestly, that's been brutal, but really important. You know, it's like, if my life was a hoarder's house, it's like taking every single thing out. But yeah, I sort of started it believing I needed to give the door a lick of paint and sort of, you know, maybe just sort of, you know, do the front garden or something. And he's like, and actually the process, I liken it to sort of exploring one's mind with an expert at mind exploring or something like that. Like the therapist isn't there to tell me anything. They're just good at, they've of course got a bright torch and they're good at asking questions, but I'm the one doing the exploring. And I was talking to my therapist this week and it was like, oh my gosh, you know, I did not realize that. For me, it was excavating religion. You know, I grew up in a very religious house and I needed to sort of excavate the entire thing. And because, yeah, it was complicated and problematic for me. You know, I was at youth events when I was 12, speaking in tongues of the spirit and rolling around believing I was a lion. And, you know, these are complicated things to grow up with, you know. And my faith changed and all sorts of things, but you can't unlive your life. And these things have profound effects on you. You know, growing up as a teenager, you know, in the world going to, you know, I went to Cream in Liverpool when I was 15, but I was also in youth groups telling me I wasn't allowed to sort of be intimate with anyone. And I couldn't, you know, I needed to live some sort of impossible saintly life. And you're trying to sort of do both. It's really, really confusing, actually.
That doesn't sound like it's a 1 hour session. But you talked about, you know, psychotherapy being an ongoing process. Is that something you're now comfortable with in terms of that being part of the journey, if you like, that regular sort of sort out, you know, the excavation, can we explore it? Is that something that you're now comfortable with tapping into? Are there aspects of that story which you're maybe not quite tapped into yet? Are there things you're quite happy now to say, yeah, they're all boxed off and they're on a nice shelf and I can sort of deal with them now. Is that process an ongoing one?
It's definitely ongoing. I couldn't possibly tell you where I am in it. I've got no idea. There will be an end, I guess, but I don't know where that is. But I can tell you some stories about, you know, specifically about the religion thing. So I'm around the time of my sort of crisis, those events eventually led to divorce and splitting up from the mother of my children. And, you know, and I'm in a new relationship now, and my partner has a child, and that child was going to a Catholic school. And as part of supporting them, we went to a Catholic service. And I mean, it was hugely traumatic for me. I sort of had to sit in the car for like hours afterwards to recover. Or I'd bring up the subject with friends, people who loved me, friends, you know. And I just, it would change my, you know, I would change. I'd go from being fine to being not fine, and, you know, terse and one word answers and traumatized, I guess, really. Recently, I was at a dinner party, and why did this come up? It was Easter weekend. That's why. So I know a lot. I know a lot about God and Jesus and Christianity. My dad's a vicar, you know, so he went to theological college when I was a child. I know a lot about this stuff. And so we were just talking about it. And anyway, ended up the subject came onto my story, and that, I realized the next day, I was like, I could talk about that. And I was fine. And I guess that's the consequence of the psychotherapy. It's like suddenly I was like, oh, this isn't a thing anymore. I'm all right. And I guess maybe I'm all right with who I am. You know, if we go back to ego and ambition, and, you know, ultimately, yeah, something quite profound has changed there. And I feel different in the world for it.
It's really interesting. And I think as well, sometimes people don't like the phrase journey, but this idea that actually it's not just a light bulb moment, oh, I'm fine now and everything's okay. This idea that it is an ongoing process, and actually it's only that you kind of go, oh, actually, yeah, I'm okay with this bit now. Let's focus on this next, or let's take a look at that. I think that's really interesting, just about people's general experience of therapy, the benefits it can bring, but also the realities of how those benefits might present themselves.
Oh yeah. I mean, and let's take this morning, for example. I mean, I've been feeling great. Yeah, this has happened quite, I mean, Easter wasn't long ago, right? It's just happened quite recently. I've had a great couple of weeks. I've been feeling really sort of full of joy and hope and self-development and all this stuff. And this morning, frankly, a bit off kilter, not feeling kind of like I'm good enough. Nothing's really changed. I've just woken up. And it's like, actually, okay, that is part of who I am and will always be part of who I am. But the difference is I know it. I'm not scared of it. And I know what to do. You know, I know how to manage myself in that situation. And it doesn't have to define my day. It isn't who I am. It's just how I feel.
What might your self-care include later on, Gowan, that you might, you're having a day like that and you're thinking, okay, not feeling it today, or I'm feeling a particular way today. I sometimes get that where you get that, I call it the shadow. You kind of go, I can just feel that shadow is just there. What are those things that you do to, what will you do later on today that might take you away from that place?
Well, one of the first things I did this morning was I exercised. I spent, you know, a good hour, just no special equipment. I'm just doing sort of, you know, press ups, sit ups, that kind of thing, stretching, just, you know, really paying attention to my body. It was only after that that I was like, no, I'm in one. So I phoned a friend, and, you know, I've got friends that I feel safe in that way with, you know, not every friend's the right friend to phone at that point, but I phoned a friend that was safe to phone in that way. He was very boundaried. He was very helpful, but he was also very boundary. He gave me 5 minutes. He was like, I need to get on my day now. But it was just nice, you know, that sense of I'm not alone. I'll play my clarinet. That's what I'll do later. Now, I'm 45. I started playing the clarinet when I was 39. And I lead these music workshops with orchestral players. And I was doing one with the City of London Symphonia. And I met this clarinet player for the first time. Now, she is incredible, like one of the world's great clarinet players. And she introduced herself and she goes, "Hi, I'm a clarinetist, and the clarinet's the easiest thing to play in the world." And later on, I'm like, "Is that true?" She goes, yeah, it's completely true. And anyway, long story short, she lent me one and I started playing. So here I am a few years later, I'm still a complete beginner. But I just get, in fact, I had to have a massive word with myself about 5 years ago because I was about to give up. And it's like, no, you're enjoying this. And it's been quite interesting. You know, I'm a professional artist. I make music for a living, or as part of my living. And being a beginner clarinetist with that, and part of my deal with myself was I bring my clarinet places, has been a real exercise in humility. But it makes me feel better. So I will blow my clarinet later. It connects my body, my breath, to some sound. I always feel better. So yeah, I'll do that.
Let's talk, Garen, about sort of where you take your passion for music now and the places you go. You don't just think, right, let's hang around outside a record shop or do a little bit of busking, that public facing thing. You've obviously taken a decision there. We talk about ambition, but I think this is an incredibly ambitious series of things that you've been doing. Taking your music to people or into places where maybe music isn't priority one, but you're obviously seeing, and there's obviously a commissioning element to it, that they see that there's a value to music and the arts within these sort of establishments. When people talk about Royal Bethlehem, for instance, they might not necessarily think that music plays a key part in that because of preconceptions about what a place like that might be. But you've gone into those sorts of places and you've taken music into conversations with, you know, young minds and organizations like that. That's an incredibly ambitious thing to do. There's obviously a space within that as well where you feel that you can really offer something from a music point of view. And I just wanted you to give me a sense of what that is and what reaction music gets when you introduce it in these environments where maybe music isn't seen as priority number one.
Yeah, so yeah, thank you. I mean, it's a lot of work in Royal Bethlehem and Maudsley hospitals, among other psychiatric hospitals as well. It's really about trying to set up an environment where people feel comfortable in making a sound. And going back to what I said about words, actually, one of the most powerful things I've discovered over years of doing this is if I can work without talking, I will. Because it's amazing how we lock ourselves up in words and don't give ourselves permission to do things. So in an example like this, where I'm going in to make music with a group of patients and the staff around them, if I was to say, "Shall we compose some music together?" Chances are people might say no. So instead, what I try and do is set up different musical experiences around the room that are playful and surprising. And they might include, you know, I build musical instruments. In fact, I happen to have, this isn't prepared actually, but I happen to have one I made for a project years ago. This is a good example, actually. I can't show you it working, but this, believe it or not, is a musical plant. And if you touch the leaves, it sings. So I'll have things like this around the room, and it's not a real plant, it's a fake plant. But I've sewn onto the leaves with conductive thread and made an electronic brain inside. So this kind of thing here. So I've just shown an electronic plant for those of you who've only got audio. So it's some leaves, and then I'm just showing up a little circuit board here, and I hook them up, and then you just touch the leaves and it sings. So I'll have things like that around the room, and maybe a shaker and some percussion, perhaps an iPad with an app on it. And the idea is you come in. Have you ever been to, I don't know if anyone's been to that, you know, like the Science Museum, they've got those playful areas for kids, you know? It's that kind of thing where you go in and you just go around and have a go. And then myself and another musician, our job then is to just join in and take these little explorations and support them musically. And 9 times out of 10, before anyone knows it, before anyone's even made the question in their head about anything, we're making some music. And that thing of, am I any good? Do I have a right to make music? Well, we're answering that because it just sounds lovely. And I might have a, you know, great violinist with me or whatever, and I'm there on a drum machine or my clarinet. And we conspire together to give it a context. And sometimes those, you know, sometimes that can go on for like 40 minutes. And in that, we connect together. And that is just really powerful. You know, it's something happens within that time that we're doing it that is absolutely priceless. I can't give it any, I can't claim anything beyond the time I'm there. I'm not going to tell you that it's healing them or that they feel better. I don't know. That's not my job. I'm not qualified to say that. But I do know that in that moment, something extraordinary is happening.
I feel like you've done two amazing things there, Gavin. You've done two amazing things. One is you've created those moments of awe and wonder for those people who maybe otherwise weren't expecting it. And the second, more frivolous, is that you've just combined my two very favorite things in the world, which is music and gardening. So yeah, you're certainly onto something with that plan. Let me make this point. If you go into a nursery with a group of 3 and 4 year olds, that experience of picking up instruments, and I've got, you know, kids now who are 5 and 9, and if there's a keyboard in the room, they will play and they will plonk and they will bat a drum and they will shake a tambourine with no rhythm, with no official rhythm, with no, you know, tune coming from it. But they will do that for a considerable period of time. But there comes a point where our brains say, this isn't very good, or you're not very good at this. Stop doing this. This doesn't sound great. But that's a learned thing, isn't it? That's something that's from outside. So obviously when you bring that into those environments, what's the thing that means that barrier doesn't come up? What gives it that acceptance of this is enough? Plonking on the, having a fiddle with a plant and bashing on this drum and watching this guy play with a clarinet. And what's the thing that allows people to continue the innocence, if you like, of the enjoyment of a moment rather than thinking, you're bad at this, stop.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is learned. Wow, what is that thing? I mean, I guess that's what I'm good at. It's giving that. You can't see on a camera or on the radio, but I'm a big lad, so maybe that helps. I don't know. You know, I'm 6'4" and not small, but I don't know. I don't know quite how I do it. One thing that really did help was, you know, as we've heard, I've been making music all my life, but during my 30s, I started to realize that my work making things like musical plants, so let's call that sound art, and my work composing music, so that's being a musician, and my work in the community that we're discussing right now, felt like three separate parts of me that were competing for attention. And that if I was doing one, I felt like I wasn't doing the others well, and I felt conflicted and difficult. And I really remember making a conscious effort. It took a while. I was like, I need to bring these three things together. They need to be one practice. And my ability to hold a space in that way that you're talking about only became as good as it is now when I started bringing my whole artistic self to the session. So it's almost like, you know, I'm coming in and saying, I as an artist, yeah, this is my studio today, the space we're in. And I, as an artist, I'm telling everyone that as far as I'm concerned, what we're doing is good enough. So regardless of what you think, But that's all nonverbal. I don't know how that comes across, but that is my very strong intention. I mean, sometimes I say it, but it's that of just like, I'm going to take this really seriously, and that in itself is enough, which is sort of difficult to believe in a way, isn't it? But it works. It really does work.
Absolutely.
I guess maybe it's this thing as also that I, you know, me and this other musician, we're really elevating it. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're putting fiendishly difficult, complex things over the top. It might just be a single note, but we're not, I guess, you know, we are there as artistic peers to the group. And I guess we're demonstrating that we're taking it seriously.
Sure, absolutely. And that gives people the permission, doesn't it, to go, well, this guy's got my back. This guy, you know, if I play this note, this guy will echo it, or this guy will feed off it. And you can kind of, it's almost like the jazz club vibe, isn't it? Of if I start doing one thing, there's a response to it. And actually that feeds that greater sense of if I put something out, then something comes back to me, and then I put something else out, that comes back to me in a slightly different way. That speaks to a much broader sense, doesn't it, of where your place is within the world.
I think you've hit on something really important there, actually, this sense of having someone's back. Because actually in art, and music, often that's not the case. We're taught to be competitive. And actually, you know, particularly in our sort of formative years, if we learn as a child and as a teenager, often as teenagers, we can be quite horrible to each other about each other's art and music. So yeah, I think maybe that's the key, is having someone's back, which then, as you said, has the result of demonstrating that someone is enough in what they're offering.
I think it's huge. Gavin, I'm so impressed by what you're doing. I know that you've been sort of well recognized for this one as well, as a Brits trailblazer as well. Congratulations on that. Do us a favor, because there's plenty of stuff that you're doing in terms of work and different types of work that people can see. You've got a website that people can go to. We'll put links in the podcast notes as well, and find out some more about what you're achieving and what you're continuing to do as well. It's been really fascinating to speak to you, and thank you for joining us on the podcast. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Mick.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.